I'm Jim Wallace from Sojourners, and this is Jim Wallace in Conversation, where we talk about justice and faith and the moral choices beneath the headlines.
With all due respect to our speaker, he and I must have read different scripture. The one that I read calls on us to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, to shelter the homeless, and to comfort the sick.
That's Joe Kennedy, congressman from Massachusetts. This is the first sitting member of Congress we've had on this show, but he's somebody I've gotten to know, and I've had a lot of good conversations with now, and I wanted you to hear yourself a conversation with Joe Kennedy. You recently spoke to the Sojourners Leadership Summit of faith leaders who focus on faith and social justice. Now, faith and social justice is not something you'll learn in Harvard Law School. What has made that connection for you?
Harvard Law School might not have been so much of a connection of faith and social justice, but there were what you do learn, I think, at any law school, is the impact that the law has in setting the framework for our society, right? Mm-hmm. It does set the ground rules and about the type of society we want, the type of society, the structures we put in place, the consumer protections we have, and the limits that we put in where we say everybody's entitled to X, and that's backed up by law. Jim, I think, you know, the most important experience that I've had professionally by far was my time as a Peace Corps volunteer in the Dominican Republic. Mm. So I spent about 2.5 years, a little less, working with a group of guys in a small little community on the outskirts of Puerto Plata, about 45 minutes south of Puerto Plata in the north central part of the Dominican Republic. And look, the guys that I live with, the community that I live with, they were no more talented than I was. They were certainly, or I was no more talented than they were. I was certainly not any smarter. I was not any more gifted. These were folks that would make a couple of dollars a day and at night would take half of their plate and scrape it on mine to share a meal. They cared for me when I was sick. They looked out after me. They brought me in as part of their community and part of their family. And it didn't take long to recognize that there was nothing that they could do, no matter the grades that they got in school or the amount that they succeeded, that was ever going to get them to Harvard Law School, that was ever going to create for them opportunities that many, but not all, even mm-hmm. in the United States, have. And look, I think to an extent, I knew that. I think probably all of your listeners know that. You can read about it. You can hear about it. You can know it. It's another thing to see it. It's another mm-hmm. thing to live it. It's another thing mm-hmm. not only to know that the experience that I have and that my lived experience is going to be different than yours or different from an inner city kid in the South or even in downtown Boston, for that matter, for me. But when those young men were going through the challenges they were going through and would still be so generous to me, I think it's impossible not to understand that there's been a moral obligation to try to make sure that we as a society make a better, a more equitable one. And to then also say, look, if the world's going to become a more complex, difficult place, you're leaving an awful lot of potential on the table for those young men and women and those families. And we need it. You need to maximize it. Talent doesn't discriminate by birth. And that means government has to break down some of these barriers and make these uh-huh. investments so that you can lift these folks up.
You said in that speech, the new guard in Washington isn't just targeting the laws that protect us. They're targeting the very idea that we are all worth protecting.
Yeah.
And they are giving cover to our darkest human instincts, hatred, intolerance, supremacy, and discrimination. Instead, you called this whole group of faith leaders to two things, dignity and decency. Mm-hmm. Explain.
Look, I think if you look at whatever version of a healthcare plan you want over the course of the past 6 months, their details were different, but structurally, they created one system of healthcare for the healthy and the wealthy, and another system for the poor and the sick and the suffering. And that was consistent across every single one of their models.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to try to find savings in our government to pay for tax reform, to lower the corporate tax rate and the tax rate for the wealthy by cutting Medicaid, healthcare for working families across this country, the elderly, the folks suffering from mental health and substance use disorder across our nation. You see it in the budget. You see it in their tax proposals. You see it in a recent announcement about who can serve in our military, where without seemingly any sort of interaction with the Defense Department, generals, Joint Chiefs of Staff, or Congress, the president tweet out a policy that not only takes thousands of service members out of the military, but makes our country weaker by doing
right.
so.
Right.
And somehow sends a statement that our mm-hmm. military isn't able to fight for the person next to you, that our country, when it comes to healthcare, isn't able and willing to shoulder a neighbor's burden when they're at their most vulnerable, they're most terrified, they're sickest, and they're most insecure. And the part that's stunning to me, Jim, is you see individuals, you see communities, you see neighbors do that every single day across our country, every single day. When a neighbor is sick or hurt or a loved one passes, your community is there for you. And at a certain point, I think we, not just our representatives here, but our country has to start asking, when is our government going to step up and be as good and decent as the people that we serve? And we're not seeing that leadership coming out of the White House these days.
So in a hearing about some of these things, you began to quote what the Gospels say about our treatment of the poor and vulnerable.
Chairman, I was struck last night by a comment that I heard made by Speaker Ryan, where he called this repeal bill, quote, an act of mercy. With all due respect to our speaker, he and I must have read different scripture. The one that I read calls on us to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, to shelter the homeless, and to comfort the sick. It reminds us that we are judged not by how we treat the powerful, but by how we care for the least among us. Mercy. Defined in purely secular terms, it's compassionate treatment for those in distress. It's kindness, and it is grace. There is no mercy in a system that makes healthcare a luxury. There's no mercy in a country that turns their back on those most in need of protection, the elderly, the poor, the sick, and the suffering. There's no mercy in a cold shoulder to the mentally ill. There's no mercy in a policy that takes for granted the sweat, the tears, and the sacrifice of working Americans that they shed every day so that they might care for their family's basic needs, food, shelter, health, and hope for tomorrow. There's no mercy
for the
2.6 million people
expired.
Who will lose their job if Obamacare is repealed. This is not an act of mercy.
Chair now recognizes the gentlelady from Washington State.
Your biblical commentary went viral. Why did you say that, and why did you bring in Matthew's gospel here in Luke?
Well, look, if I had thought that Matthew and Luke would have gone viral in a committee hearing, I probably would have done it a while ago. that it certainly was a surprise to me that it resonated as powerfully as it did. The quote that you're referring to in the hearing was, again, around healthcare, and as the House of Representatives started their own healthcare repeal effort in a 28-hour hearing, and the day before, a couple of days before, Speaker Ryan had called this repeal effort an act of mercy, despite the fact that it was gutting Medicaid and kicking millions of people off insurance. And look, the speaker's a decent man, and I do believe that. My differences with him are not personal. We do have a profound difference in belief about the role of the federal government and what a government can and should do to ensure that every single person gets access to quality, affordable health care. And I thought that the characterization of kicking people off of healthcare and using federal dollars and stripping that away from families in need so that the wealth can get a bigger tax cut, and somehow characterizing that as an act of mercy just goes against everything that I was taught, not just as a young kid growing up and not just by going to church and not just through a Catholic faith, but just from your parents, from society, from just the basic tenets of decency and what mercy is supposed to be about. It's about caring for somebody else. It's about showing compassion. It's about empathy. It's about understanding that sometimes faults and failings aren't your fault. They just happen, and they're going to happen to all of us at some point, particularly when it comes to healthcare. We all hope we're not going to get sick, but you do.
You said there, but for the grace of God, go I.
And, yeah. But the one guarantee I can give almost every single person listening and everybody else is that at some point in your life, the sky is going to fall because a loved one's going to get sick, somebody's going to get an accident, something terrible is going to happen to somebody that you care about. It's life. That part of it is vicious and unforgiving. The question is our country good enough and strong enough to say, when that happens to you, you can count on me. When that happens to you, we will be there for you. Recognizing that not only would I hope just morally and I think out of decency that you get that help and support when you need it, but because I know that at some point that's going to happen to me too, and I want to be able to rest on a friend and loved one's shoulder, and I want to be able to know that if you do become weak at the knees at some point, there's going to be someone else there to lift you up and get you to where you need to go. And all of this rhetoric around making America great, you can't make America great if you don't believe that our people already are and have the capacity to be great. You can't believe that and then destroy the very fabric of the our communities that make it so. And I think that's what President Trump and his vision for our society and what's coming out of this administration, that's what they do.
It's not as usual for Democrats to quote scripture, and you did Matthew 25, where Jesus says, I was hungry, I was sick, it was me. Mm-hmm. As you've done to the least of these, you've done to me. And that's what you quoted.
Yeah. And look, I think that sentiment runs through an awful lot of my colleagues. We have a diverse, you know, I think one of the strengths of the Democratic caucus in particular is you've got folks that come from diverse backgrounds, diverse biographies, diverse faith histories and experiences. But you do have, I think, a connective thread through them that government has the capacity and I think responsibility to lift people up, to celebrate them, to recognize the dignity behind every single person and the decency that we are capable of. And that we are at our strongest as a country when you celebrate both of those things and you empower those values and you challenge a nation to say, this is what we're capable of. I know you can meet it. Let's meet it together. Because if we do that, we can tackle any of these challenges that confront us, whether that's healthcare or immigration or the most complex foreign policy dynamic we've seen since World War II. All of those are human problems, all of them. They're human creations. They can be solved. But they take real leadership, they take a collective effort, and they take a willingness to say, we're going to suck it up and we're going to go it together, recognizing that when we do make that commitment, when we do make that sacrifice, when we do make that push, people are going to ask something of you, but that there's a higher calling when that happens.
When you spoke to us, there was a passion, and as our listeners are hearing now, there's a passion in you about these moral choices. You said, our country is being torn apart at the seams. You were speaking there of our moral fabric. You're going beyond partisan politics here and calling for a moral politics.
Look, some of my closest friends here in Washington are Republicans. I was at dinner with a number of them last night. They're good and decent people. They care for their kids. They care for their families. They're very generous to their neighbors. They're people of faith. Some of them have been pastors and ministers themselves. I don't deny that. I think that's actually a cause for celebration and a common cause that many members of Congress in the House and Senate actually share, but probably gets overlooked so often. And I try to understand that my colleagues believe that they're doing what is right for their districts, for their states, for their country, because if they didn't, they wouldn't be elected too. I do think, though, we've seen the political discourse in this country change over the course of the past several years and obviously culminating with some of the rhetoric and vitriol that's come out of the White House in a course of an extremely divisive political campaign. And I think on the one hand, it's hard for any one person to change that problem. It's bigger than any one person. On the other hand, undeniably, Congress as a whole, government as a whole, certainly has a responsibility in that. And our hands aren't clean. And so the question is, again, collectively, are we willing to and able to stand strong on principle? And it doesn't mean you back down from criticizing or critiquing somebody's judgment. But it does mean you don't have to malign their character. It does mean that you can say, look, we will disagree. If you have to make a value choice between making investments in the poor or tax cuts for the rich, there's a value choice there. And I think one is, one likes paying taxes. Of course, I'd rather have lower taxes. Let's make sure that the basic needs of our society are met before we need to ensure that somebody else can buy their sixth yacht. The issue then isn't the debate around judgment. The issue is trying to then say, just because we disagree on what those policies should be or the ranking of those values doesn't mean that all of a sudden somebody else is a bad person or an evil person or that they're somehow deliberately trying to destroy what we hold dear. I do think you can criticize them without, again, maligning their character and integrity.
So why is faith core to this? You said to these faith leaders, I'm here tonight with a simple mission to ask for your help.
Because I think that at a time, uniquely to those faith leaders, you get to see almost on a daily basis, individuals at their brightest moments, their most proud, the celebrations that they're going to cherish throughout the course of their lives, marriages particularly, but graduations, christenings, holy ceremonies, that people are proud and form these milestones in life that you celebrate when you look back on them, and you're there for them. You're also there to give counsel in our weakest moments, at the ones where a loved one has fallen, at the times when we don't live up to our values and we have failed, our own moral failures and otherwise. And you're there to counsel people through it. You see us at our best and you see us at our weakest, and you stand by us when we are at both. You see resilience and strength and potential when we are weak. And you know when we're strong that that's also only temporary. And you got people that are standing by your side wherever you are on that spectrum, at those highest peaks and those deepest valleys. And our country's seesawing between those at the moment. There are parts of our economy, there's parts of our country that are extremely strong at the moment, and we should celebrate them. There's parts that are not, and we got to recognize that. But I think faith leaders have a unique opportunity to understand that rhythm and that nothing is ever final, nothing is ever permanent, and to provide us with some guidance and some wisdom along the way.
I love your passion. I love the fact that you want even your party to be more receptive and friendly to faith. And it's a delight, always a delight to be with you and have these conversations.
Thanks
and
for
I'm
having
very
me.
Grateful for you.
Appreciate it, my friend.
That was Joe Kennedy, congressman from the 4th District of Massachusetts. And you could feel and hear his passion in what he was saying. He wasn't talking about his political concerns or philosophy or even political priorities. It was deeper than that. So when I asked him, what for you makes you go deeper? What is your passion? Why are you so passionate about all this? What did he say? He talked about his experience in the Peace Corps, in the Dominican Republic, with people whose names he still remembers and whose sacrifice for him, who's sharing their food with him, who's looking out for him, is something he recalls to this day. That's what changes us. I've always said that I've learned most about the world from being in places I was never supposed to be or meeting and getting to know people I was never supposed to know. That's what changes us. And clearly, it has changed Joseph Kennedy. When a politician speaks about the image of God in all of us, in all human beings, it opens up a moral conversation about the value and equality under the law for all of our citizens, all of God's children. And you can hear that and feel that in Joe Kennedy's voice. Of course, many would say that the wealth and the power of the Kennedy family removes them from proximity to those who are poor and vulnerable. But he acted to get closer, to unremove himself. That's what we all have to ask. When we are removed, we don't get it. We can read about it, we can hear about it, we can even feel concerned, but we don't get it until we get close. That's what Joe Kennedy did in the Dominican Republic, and he's done that ever since. And he listens, he listens. So this is something we all have to look at. Where are we removed? How can we get closer into proximity to those who are being most impacted and listen to them? And that will change us. We are stuck in politics, looking and hoping for some new voices on both sides of the aisle. Joe Kennedy could be one of those voices and leaders to transcend our predictable partisan politics that have entrenched us by speaking moral values like dignity, decency, diversity, and the values of faith. Thank you, Joe. Our program is produced by Kitty Isley and engineered by Paul Woody Woodhall. The executive producer is Lee Hernandez. Thanks to Eric Newsom, Senior Vice President of Original Content Development for Audible. I'm Jim Wallace. I hope you'll come back to join me here next time for Jim Wallace in Conversation.